This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Jim Martin has a doctorate in chemistry from Princeton University. He holds 4 patents, taught chemistry at Davidson College. He's composed classical music and has played with the Charlotte Symphony, but that is not what he's famous for. Jim Martin was a 2-time North Carolina governor and has been described as a catalyst for fundamental change in the state, perhaps the spearhead of the Republican Revolution in Raleigh. Those words come from his biographer and author of Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans. That catalyst himself is with us in our studio for the hour. Governor Martin, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning. To be here.
Nice to have you. And to make sure that we get the story straight, the governor's biographer, John Hood, is with us. He's also the chairman of the board for the John Locke Foundation, and he joins us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill. Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much, Mike.
I want to find out about these patents, first of all. We'll talk about politics. And what are the 4 patents for?
While I was a student at Davidson, before my senior year, I worked at the Standard Oil Research Laboratory in New Jersey, and they assigned me to work on butyl rubber. That's the rubber that used to be in the inner tubes, because it doesn't decay with ozone. And I worked on the vulcanization of butyl rubber and had some very nice little patents.
Do you get money for the patents, or did they take the money from you?
They gave me $25 for each one.
There's something wrong with that formula.
Well, I assigned them to them. That was the rule, right. And I was happy to do it.
You started your life, obviously, as a scientist. Do you see some sort of an internal connection between what goes on in a scientist's brain and the processes a scientist uses to go through experimentation and solve problems and what a politician does?
Well, scientists, we tend to think of ourselves as the kind of folks that reason very logically. But as you'll notice, we have some pretty good disputes within our subject matter, and that's what science is about, to try to disprove the principles that someone else had laid down.
But as a scientist, sure, you're working with other people, but you're pretty much alone in your own thought process, and you're kind of your own boss.
Well, not really, because you have a team working together most of the time.
But you're not under the slings and arrows of the public, because politicians can never do anything right. And you probably found that out with your first job. You were a Mecklenburg County commissioner, a 6-time congressman, a 2-time governor. When did all this begin? When did your interest in politics
begin? Well, Mike, I would have to say that sometimes politicians get things right. It's just you don't hear much about it. It's not newsworthy when you do something right. It's only newsworthy when you mess up.
Well, what I meant by that is that even if you get it right and some constituents think you got it right, there will inevitably be some constituents who think you got it wrong.
Yep.
So you can never do anything right. You're always wrong to somebody. And that's not a good position I would want to be in, I don't think.
Well, a big change now is that you have all these different innovations of social media where there's a lot of information and informationoids are floating around in the social media, things that are accepted because it reinforces what you already believe. And that was different when you relied on the news media to get out the news and to study it and decide whether there was facts behind it.
Was it better then?
I thought it was, yeah.
I think that's maybe the first time a politician has ever told me that it was better getting the news from the media.
I'm talking about the news. We could argue with the editorial content of a newspaper, for example, because they tended to be more in the pocket of the Democrats. I mean, it's just the way it was back in those days. Once the Charlotte News went down, it was more Republican, more conservative paper. The Charlotte Observer was the only one left standing.
Right.
And yet every once in a while, they would endorse me, and I was very happy to have it.
Where did this begin, this interest in politics?
Well, it was late in life. It was after I got to Davidson and was teaching. During my college and most of my graduate school days, I had very little interest in politics. But one friend, Bill Purcell, who was a fellow graduate student in chemistry, introduced me to this new magazine called National Review. And I started reading it and a couple of other things in the nation and began to form my own ideas, but didn't do much with it until I got to Davidson and registered as a Republican, not so much because of any ideological reasons, because back then most Southern Democrats were conservative. most Southern conservatives were Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had thought about running for office then, I would have probably registered as a Democrat. You know, we were told even then that you had to register as a Democrat, otherwise your vote wouldn't count because the election was in the primary.
Mm.
The Republicans weren't going to win anything. Well, of course, that wasn't entirely true because we had a Republican congressman, Charles Jonas, whom I later succeeded.
So why swim against the tide? Was it simply because that's where your affinity lay or lied?
It was a personal protest. My family were Democrats, and because everyone was
right.
In South Carolina. My wife's family and they were Democrats.
She was a registered Democrat when she first
ran for office. That's
correct, yeah.
And I registered as Republican as a protest movement on my own. I didn't think at the time that I would ever have any involvement in changing politics to build a two-party South. But I thought that was holding not just South Carolina and North Carolina, but all of the Southern states, I thought, were handicapped, not just politically, but economically, because of the dominance of one party.
Yeah, you believe in a two-party system.
That was why I registered Republican, yes. Very seriously.
And even now when the Democrats are trying to scramble to get back into control in North Carolina, you have called that healthy.
Well, it is healthy. I think you need two-party competition. One of the problems we have, of course, is that both parties have become more, extreme, more polarized. Republicans further to the right, Democrats further to the left, partly, as some would point out, because of the way legislative districts are drawn, but also partly because moderates have pulled out of both parties.
Yeah.
Right now, the Republicans dominate the elected offices in the state, but they're not the most numerous registration. In fact, Republicans are third behind Democrats and no party. But we're strong enough to be competitive, and back in 1960, we were not very strong.
John Hood, as I sit here listening to the governor, it reminds me of how things used to be before. I don't want to blame it on the Tea Party, but it's certainly within recent memory. When Democrats and Republicans could disagree but get along, when Democrats and Republicans could argue their ideology and be accepting, at least for a moment, of the outcome, whether one side won or one side lost, and be civil about it. Can we come back to that, John Hood?
I think we can. I think there are a number of reasons why we've gotten to where we are, and it's important not to over-sanitize or fantasize about the past, though it had some obvious advantages in political discourse. One of the reasons why Democrats and Republicans got along better in North Carolina many years ago is because the Democrats never felt threatened. They didn't think they were going to lose the legislature. There were communities where they didn't think they would ever not be in charge, and you can be magnanimous when you feel very secure. When politics got more competitive, when the fall election mattered more than the spring election, both sides started to get more serious about this, and that led to conflict. But I think your initial point about the change of media and the rise of social media plays a tremendous role in this and really obviously predates the Tea Party phenomenon. It really facilitated it, which is that people can now search out news outlets, sources of information on the internet, whether it be good or bad, that reinforce their preconceived notions, that allow them to live in a sort of a cocoon of self-fulfilling expectations. And the news that you read confirms what you thought would happen. And when everybody does that, when both sides do that, you have a hard time imagining how a rational, reasonable, nice person could come to a completely different conclusion from you on an issue. That's the beginning of the problem.
Yeah.
If you can find something that just reinforces what you already believe, you don't have to listen to the other side.
Which is exactly what's happening on both sides of the case. But, you know, the conservatives will tell you that the media, by and large, is liberal, except for Fox News, perhaps, and the Breitbart Report and a couple of other things. It's a liberal-controlled media.
I would say that, yes.
You would say that. Yeah. Why do you say that? Aside from the editorial page, what is liberal about CBS News?
Ideally,
or
the editorial page is distinct and separate and insulated from – ideally – from the news gathering, but it's going to have that influence because the management enters into decisions of whether they're going to bring in this young journalism student from a particular university or another one. and that's going to enter into the shading of it, just as it does in college faculties.
How much of it has to do, I guess, with the fact that news outlets are, particularly in newspapers, or all over the country, actually, news outlets are trying to hire young people and not pay them much. and young people are more liberal.
Liberals are cheaper?
Well, no, just that young people are more liberal usually than older people. You become more conservative as you get older. And if you're a young person not making a lot of money, you're identifying with people who would identify with the left. How much of it do you think is that?
I don't know. I think it probably is true to some extent, but I think it's what I'm saying is that it's more a reflection of the philosophy at the journalism school where they go.
Okay. As a Republican governor, you had a Democratic legislature and you took what was described as a pragmatic center-right approach. Had you had a Republican legislature, would that approach have been different?
Might have been. The issues would have been different. I would have still have had some difficulty. You look at Governor Hunt, for example, a strong Democrat, very able campaigner, had only Democratic legislatures, but he had difficulties with them also, particularly with regard to separation of powers. It's inherent in those who are elected to the legislature to just naturally feel that not only are they entitled to write the laws, what the Constitution says, but also to have great influence on how the laws are carried out. That's why they start appointing 2/3 of the members of most commissions that help to execute the laws. And that's why we had a little set to recently that Governor Hunt and I joined Governor McCrory in a lawsuit to stop the General Assembly from intruding into the executive power of appointment.
Talk to me for a second, because you were governor for 8 years, about the job of governor and the relationship between the governor and the legislature. Pat McCrory is a Republican. He has a Republican legislature. And as you point out, he's having some problems with that legislature. What does that say about
the first year?
So what does that say about either the Constitution of North Carolina or about the governor's office and how it's and the powers therein?
I think it's more the latter, not just the governor's office, but the legislator's office too. There's a latent rivalry between the two that's always been there and is always going to be there. As I said, it was true when Governor Hunt had Democratic legislatures. It was true when Governor Martin had Democrat legislatures, a Republican working with them. Sometimes we had worked together, but I found that far more than I had expected, there was a built-in tendency to distrust me before I even got there.
Before is that because you're from Mecklenburg County?
No, because I was a Republican who had been elected governor. And immediately they started taking away the power to appoint the election director. I had no reason to remove him.
Right.
Though he was a Democrat, I knew him personally, and I knew that he was a very honorable fellow, and he was going to stay. I kept a lot of Democrats in their positions. Yeah. After all, when I ran in 1984, I got more votes from Democrats than there were Republicans. So I had to be able to work with them.
Governor,
but the legislature was a different animal.
Governor Jim Martin's our guest. He's the subject of a book by John Hood, Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans. John Hood is also with us, and we're going to talk to you, John, when we come back about this book, this man, and why now, among other things. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Green Power, promoting a cleaner, brighter energy future for North Carolina schools through a grant program to install small solar PV arrays, ncgreenpower.org. And Cat Wealth Consulting, LLC, Martha Cat, is a financial advisor specializing in retirement planning for State of North Carolina employees, online at catwealth.com. It's an art scene doubleheader, beginning with an Opera Carolina doubleheader. Two operas back-to-back with similar themes, but by different composers. We hear about Aleko and Pagliacci, and from the lead in Pagliacci, who sings all over the world, but is making his Carolina debut, and ironically, he lives in Rock Hill. Van Actors Theater is on the move. Their longtime home is becoming an apartment. What this means for Charlotte's only professional theater company on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new report finds that family members caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's are making even greater financial sacrifices than previously thought, like cutting back on work hours and selling personal belongings. Why Alzheimer's is one of the most costly diseases for families and the nation.
The Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Governor Jim Martin, a two-time North Carolina governor, six-time congressman, a Mecklenburg County commissioner. Only lost one race. We'll talk about that in a second.
And a two-time governor, is that what
you said? No. Two-term governor, I should say. John Hood is also with us. He's the governor's biographer. His recent book is called Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of the North Carolina Republicans. Why this book about this man now, John Hood?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that it was a story that needed to be told. Governor Martin was a very interesting political figure in North Carolina, a very effective leader, and lots of people are curious about him. You know, many people served in his administration or remember when he was a governor for 8 years from 1985 to 1993, and so they're curious. But there's a larger reason, which is that, as you can tell from the subtitle, this is a book about a particular individual who played a role in a large-scale political change in North Carolina, a change from a one-party Democratic state, which was true when Jim Martin registered as a Republican and first ran for office as a Republican in the 60s. It was overwhelmingly Democratic. Only about, you know, six, seven counties out of 100 had significant Republican strength anywhere other than for president, let's say, or Congress. And today we live in a very different political culture in North Carolina. In 2012, for the first time, there was an elected Republican and an elected legislature that was Republican, and the Supreme Court was Republican, and most counties had Republican governments. And as a result, there is a lot of interest in how did this come about? What did this process look like? And in the past, when people discuss this issue, they tended to focus purely on national trends, the effects of presidents like Nixon or Reagan, which is certainly there, or they would talk about U.S. Senator Jesse Helms because of his very prominent role in North Carolina Republican politics. But those factors don't explain the rise of the Republicans sufficiently. It certainly doesn't explain how Republicans started to win legislative races or county commission races. And to do that, you really have to examine the career of your guest, Jim Martin.
Well, if Governor Martin is, as you say in the title of your book, the catalyst for this, and I know you're playing off his chemistry background there, but if he in fact is the catalyst for this, what was it that he did that allowed Republicans to start making inroads in a Democratic state to the point where they now control the state everywhere?
Well, it's a good point. And by the way, the political culture has evolved to competition. Republicans have won a lot of the recent races, mm-hmm. but they could lose races this November. It's that competitive, and that's really the message here.
Okay.
One of the things that's very clear is that Jim Martin and others who were involved in this process in North Carolina and in other southern states realized that conservative politics, which really defined the Republican Party, right-of-center politics, needed to be more than just resistance to communism and thoughts about what Washington should do, that you really needed to have a center-right message about how to deliver roads and keep them in good shape, how to deliver schools and provide excellent educational opportunities, how to encourage business to grow, entrepreneurs to start businesses in your community. And you needed a Republican message on that, in addition to the symbolic issues and the national and international issues that Republicans tended to think about in the 60s and 70s, you needed a practical philosophy for governing if you wanted people to elect you to govern.
Is this what you meant when you developed a second Southern strategy, Governor Martin, or helped develop that second Southern strategy, a way to find appealing alternatives to Democratic policies?
You'll see in the first chapter, the very first chapter, Mike, how a group of us got together with Lamar Alexander, myself, mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich, Carol Campbell, Connie Mack, to talk about why it was that Republicans could now and then get the majority of votes for president or governor or state senator and a few members of the House of Representatives. But down the ballot, county commissioners, state legislators, is very hard. Sheriffs, the Democrats dominated that, and we saw the reason was because those campaigns were not as well publicized and people didn't know as much about them. So after a conservative Democrat would vote for Nixon or Reagan at the top of the ticket and for Lamar and myself for governor, they'd look at the rest of the ballot and they didn't know who those people were. They'd just pull the straight party ticket. And so one of the things that was a very practical item of political science was we went out all across the South, all the southern states, to persuade conservative Democrats to switch their registration to Republican, put their registration where their mind was.
That seems like a very difficult thing to accomplish.
Well, it was, but it worked. One of the things we did—
How did you do it? What was the selling point? What made somebody do that?
One thing is to make a campaign of it, just start to emphasize that, and then to recruit a group of, let's call them bell cow conservative Democrats, like the chairman of the county commission in Wake County, Mr. Knott. He was co-chair of the effort and helped persuade others across the state to help take the lead. And within a year, we had not a majority, but we had enough that we could be competitive in that way. We could recruit better candidates. We could back, give them better support, and elect more Republicans.
I have two guys here who understand Republican politics probably better than anybody else that I can get on that I can count on the fingers of my hands. Which was more effective? This approach, this pragmatic approach, this approach toward encouraging entrepreneurism and finding ways to help small people in counties around states and then build your organization from the ground up, or getting involved in social issues that Republicans seem to be entangled in constantly now?
Well, back in the period when this book is about, the 26 years that I was in office, it was more of the former, getting organized, developing a core of workers. We had what we call the Neighbors Program, where we had at least one person on every block of the Republican precincts who would be sure that materials were handed out. It's a small thing.
So when you talk—
But as we got to where the party was more competitive and could begin to win not only legislative seats, but, wow, even judicial seats. For almost a century, no Republican had been elected Superior Court judge or the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court because nobody knew what they stood for, and so they just vote for their party Democrats. We got it to where they started electing some Republicans, and that's why the Democratic legislature changed it so that they would be nonpartisan. Of course, you still know which candidates are Democrats and which are Republicans because the workers at the poll will tell you.
John,
both parties.
In his congressional years, you described Jim Martin as being conventionally conservative. What does that mean in 21st century speak?
Well, what that means is that quite specifically, if you analyze the votes of Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives in the 70s and early 80s, Jim Martin, representing the 9th Congressional District, was at or to the right of the center point of Republicans in the Congress. If you pick any particular issue that Republicans in the 70s and 80s were involved in, it could be international policy. It could be the nuclear freeze movement, which Jim Martin helped to defeat. It could be the passage of the Reagan tax cuts in 1981 and the previous enactment of tax cuts, supply-side tax cuts in the late 70s. Jim Martin not only voted for these measures, but he helped in some cases to craft these measures.
Yeah.
Today, or even during his gubernatorial term, people tended to assume, because of what he was saying on a particular issue, that he was in some way very different from, say, Jesse Helms in his service in Congress. And the truth is that he was, as I said, a conventionally conservative member of Congress, and I think that's important for people to understand. In fact, a lot of the book is about his days on the county commission in Mecklenburg and his 12 years in Congress, because it was very important. It was an important period of time, and it set the stage for a lot of what he either sought to do or actually accomplished when he was governor.
While you were in Congress, as John just alluded to, you backed Ronald Reagan's supply-side economics, which postulates, if I'm correct about this, that by lowering taxes on corporations, governments can stimulate investment in industry and raise production, which will in turn bring down prices and control inflation, if that's it in a nutshell.
That's true, if the taxes to begin with are too high.
Okay.
If you draw on a piece of paper a graph of the revenue that you can get at a different percent tax rate. Suppose your tax rate is zero, how much revenue are you going to get? Zero. Suppose your tax rate is 100%, mm-hmm. how much revenue are you going to get? Zero. Because nobody's going to earn anything if you're going to tax it at 100%.
Okay.
Somewhere in between there is the peak of the curve, and if you're above that, the taxes are too high. You've got to lower the taxes. And we thought that was the case then.
Is supply-side economics the same as trickle-down economics?
It can be called that. It gets that term.
Because people have said that trickle-down economics doesn't really
people
work.
People have money, they invest it, right. That trickles down to
right.
jobs.
Does that work, in
well,
your opinion?
Well, of course it does. If people don't invest and create jobs, who's going to do it? The government? That's what Bernie Sanders is for. Well, he is. I mean, he's an avowed socialist. That
yes,
he believes
is.
That.
Today's Republicans in Raleigh have come under fire in some corners for cutting corners.
Avowed is a strong word, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a strong word. That's your word.
He says he is.
Well, he is. Not that there's anything wrong with that, mind you. Just another
just avowed is a strong word.
Today's Republicans rally have come under fire for cutting corners on education from some people. When you were governor, you have been credited with doubling education spending from $1.8 to $3.3 billion. You're credited with being a strong supporter of expanding the teaching of foreign languages. You also advocated a system of merit pay for teachers, which the legislature turned down, but you advocated for it. How do you characterize the current approach of the legislature toward education?
Well, part of that growth in spending was because of the growth of the state and growth of revenues and the growth of the number of students in the public schools. But part of it was because for the first time in about 30 years, every budget that I submitted increased the percentage of the general fund, the percentage of the general fund that went for public schools. And no previous education governor, although they could certainly call themselves that, no one had done that.
Mm-hmm.
They had reduced the percentage of the general fund that went for public schools. And that's the Democrats and Republicans. So I was able to turn that around. Now, as far as pay for teachers, you remember that problem first occurred in 2008 when the Democrats were in power and were not able to provide pay increases because of the economy. And for the first couple of years of the Republican control, they had to struggle with that too. But in the last 2 years, the Republicans have begun to move toward improving the pay on average. And, of course, they're doing it for the younger teachers, which is not as popular for the senior teachers who've been around a while. They would like to see some of that too. But I think everybody would recognize that we've got to have a better way to recruit young people to come into teaching. And the next step, the next stage, they tell me, is that they'll begin now to provide a better arrangement for the senior teachers as well.
It was a very different time when you were on the county commission in Mecklenburg, but the county funds the public schools in Mecklenburg County. And you were in the classroom. You were a teacher at Davidson College. You were a professor there.
Well, most of public school money comes from the state.
Okay.
But the counties are allowed to supplement that, or the cities if they have a city school system.
So having been in the classroom as an instructor, having been on a county commission, looking at local school systems, et cetera, having been the governor of North Carolina and advocating for teacher pay and more money for education, whether it's because of growth and the need for more buildings and more teachers, or whether it's because you believe in education, which you probably do because you are a scientist and a professor. You have a doctorate.
You're doing good so far.
Have we asked the public schools to do too much? If you had to put your finger on what is right or what is wrong with the public schools, what would it be?
You know, even back then, it was beginning to be a concern, and I think it's more so now, about the degree of misbehavior of students in schools. I read something the other day in the newspaper about the number of of cases of violence of strong young men in the school system and girls, boys and girls, violence against the teacher. And for most people, they just don't want to have to put up with that. And the school system has not been able to manage that very well, so far as I could tell. Yeah. I know they need to, and they need help.
It's a societal problem.
And to have a police officer in the classroom.
Yeah, it's a societal problem, but it seems that people want to blame the schools. Should they be blaming the schools, or should they be blaming themselves? Because they're the parents.
Well, you know, they tend to blame the other students' parents.
That's true. You oversaw the creation of this state's highway trust fund. You backed a fuel tax hike to step up road construction, and we're behind bond issues for road improvements. Today, we don't seem to be able to count on government anywhere for major infrastructure problems. We're always being told there's not enough money for that. And the I-77 toll lanes are a prime example of this, and that's a political hot potato in North Carolina. What are your thoughts on that project?
Well, let's comment on the problem. First of all, you said that the state government is not able to find the additional revenues to provide for widening lanes on I-77 and other major thoroughfares across the state. And that's partly because people don't like to pay the taxes that they pay here because it's cheaper in South Carolina and Virginia, where they don't have the money to work on their roads that we have here.
And South Carolina has better roads.
I don't know that I
have. Have you been to Rock Hill?
Of course I have. I've been all over the state of South. I know that. If you're looking at that one stretch of road with that wide thoroughfare, that's really nice. But you can find that up by Salisbury. You can find that going by Burlington because of the influence of people from those areas were able to do very well.
I'm sure you've driven on the interstate.
My point is that the tax on gasoline is already high, higher than the surrounding states, and that makes it difficult to raise taxes even more. We were able to do that by arguing that you could get something for your money. It wouldn't be—
Mike, there's a really important point that needs to be understood about comparing, for example, North and South Carolina on taxes and spending for roads, which is that different states pay for roads in different ways. North Carolina has a relatively high motor fuels tax, partly because we have a relatively low property tax. In places like South Carolina, they pay for a lot of their road system with local property taxes, something that we don't. They pay for it in many states with sales taxes.
Except when I lived in South Carolina, the property tax was significantly lower than it is here. Significantly.
Well, in general, that is not correct. I mean, it might have been true in your case, but when I took the numbers recently and looked at the various taxes that are used for highways, North Carolina was not high. It was actually lower than average.
We have to take a break. We'll come back
and
talk more about
toll roads.
Yes, yes, sir, I do. Okay. Yes, sir, I do. Governor Jim Martin is with us in the studio. John Hood is with us in Chapel Hill. He's the biographer of the book we're talking about. Well, about with the subject we're talking to, Catalyst. Coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University Charlotte campus hosting an open house on April 30th for those interested in graduate degrees and certificate programs. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte Open House. And Live Nation featuring VIP premium seats for business and personal use, box suites and seats and tickets available at PNC Music Pavilion and Uptown Amphitheater. More information at livenationpremiumseats.com. A new report finds that family members caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's are making even greater financial sacrifices than previously thought, like cutting back on work hours and selling personal belongings. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10, Diane talks with a panel of guests about why Alzheimer's is one of the most costly diseases for families and the nation. Want to join our conversation with Governor Martin? Now's your shot. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Get to us through Facebook at WFAE or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We are coming right back.
When playwright Sarah Burgess started writing her play about private equity firms, it was like learning a new language.
I think I was really drawn to the challenge of writing about a world that I'm not inside, but trying to sort of, at least to some degree, in a simplified form, mimic the way they might talk to each other when there's not an outsider present.
I'm Adrienne Hill. A play about finance that's also a comedy. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Governor Jim Martin, a two-term governor in North Carolina, the first and only two-term Republican governor in North Carolina, and the subject of a book called Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of North Carolina Republicans, written by John Hood, who was also our guest today from a studio in Chapel Hill. Let's getting back to this toll lane project, which has people all upset, and a lot, and we're told that all future major road projects in North Carolina will be toll lane projects because there's no money there's not enough money coming from the gasoline tax to fund the construction of roads. But is it a good idea to farm this out to a private company and give them the license to operate it for 50 years? If it's such a good idea, why can't the state operate it?
Well, I would agree with your premise that the state could operate it, and I would have thought the state would have been better off to finance it with bond issues and ask the public to support the bond issues and then the state to operate it. In the case of the celebrated toll lanes in Texas where the company down there went bankrupt, the state's likely to end up operating that one, and it'll be just as if the state had built it because those lanes are already built. In other words, they're not going away because of the bankruptcy. At the beginning, I had objections and reservations about the whole prospect, but it's done. It's moving. And as someone who lives in the Lake Norman area of Iredell County, when I come to Charlotte, I would like to have an option to get on a toll lane when you have wrecks and other traffic jams along I-77, just as I did this morning. I had to leave a half hour earlier just to be able to have time to get here through that traffic. So one other thing I found as I looked into it is that the General Assembly, I believe it was then Speaker Tom Tillis, now U.S. Senator, put in there that any community that accepted, not just I-77, but any community that accepted toll lanes would get additional money as a percentage of the cost of that, additional monies for their local highways. And in this case, there's like $143 million additionally for North Carolina 115, U.S. 21. Those are the parallel roads that people dump onto when there's a problem on I-77. And those are not going to be toll lanes. People could get there and would have faster traffic on 21 than I had this morning.
This may not be accurate. It could be an accurate perception on my part, and it comes from talking to people on both sides of this issue on this program. But the people who are against this seem to know a lot more about it and a lot more about the players than the people who are in favor of it. And I've never been able to get a straight answer out of anybody about what these lanes will cost, because they will fluctuate in price given the traffic flow.
I mean, what they're going charge to get on them.
Exactly. And no one will say. No one will even put out a hypothetical figure. They just won't do it. This whole thing smells bad to me. Does it smell bad to you? You've been in politics your whole life.
No, I don't think of it in those terms of smelling bad. I mean, that implies corruption.
Well, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, in the way that you phrased it, it doesn't, but isn't it basically a marketplace where if the company Centra or their subsidiary charges too high a rate, they're not going to get as many people, and so they won't make as much revenue.
Right.
If they charge too low a rate, they'll get more people come, but they won't make enough revenue. So they're going to have to find just the right balance, and this allows them to do that.
You are.
It's just like that curve that we were talking about,
right?
Taxes, and in fact, that was the problem down in Texas, the state of Texas, not taxes, where they didn't get enough revenue, which is why they went bankrupt after it was built.
The governor was known throughout his congressional career and his life in the governor's office, John, as a pragmatic conservative, et cetera, and had a willingness to act in a bipartisan manner. Today, Republicans particularly, but also Democrats, are pretty much locked in. Their feet are in cement. They're not going to budge. There is no room for compromise. Which is the better approach?
Well, it's better to be in a position where you have strong opinions, but you're willing to work with people on the other side to get a particular policy enacted. Even if you get 70% of what you want, it's better than getting 0% of what you want. But the premise of your question suggests that this is not the case today, and I would suggest that in North Carolina, lots and lots of things have been enacted with bipartisan votes. There was a, speaking of transportation, there was a complete rewrite of the transportation formula for North Carolina, how highways were funded. I thought that would be a huge fight in 2013, something that Governor McCrory had been pushing and members of the legislature. It got almost unanimous approval and was a tremendous achievement. We've seen even recently bills that, like the ordinance out of Charlotte that got overturned by the bathroom bill in the legislature, that was a bipartisan vote. I mean, it might have been a good vote or a bad vote, but it wasn't the case of the two sides.
There were 8 Democrats who voted for that, and all of the Democratic senators walked out.
Because otherwise
they would have had to vote for it.
Some of them would.
I mean, that's how they hid their vote. That is precisely what occurred, and I mean no disrespect for the state senators I know who are Democrats, but we all know that there would have been a number of state senators, Democrats, who would have voted for the bill. That's why they had to stage the walkout.
So we have an email from Jean who says, please ask Governor Martin if the passage of HB 2, the bill we're talking about here, represents the North Carolina that he knows and loves.
I would say it represents the North Carolina that we have right now. And it's another example of what we talked about earlier, the polarization of the state, where you have – I'll start with the city first. The city is dominated by Democrats in the city council who are much more liberal than they would have been back in the time that I was in office. And so they – felt it was their duty and obligation and opportunity to enact an ordinance that went much further than conservatives would like to see.
Some say, including the Attorney General, that it enshrines in law discrimination. Does it?
Well, when I'm talking about the city ordinance, is that what you're saying?
Are
you
referring? No, HB 2.
Well, I'm trying to set the stage for it.
Okay.
You have the left doesn't listen to the right, the concerns that people on the other side had, and when the conservatives would say we're concerned about some man coming into the women's restroom, the liberals interpret that to mean, oh, they're afraid of transgender males who have gone from female to male. No, they're not. That's not their fear. Their fear is of pedophiles and sex offenders who would take advantage of that and they may be right, they may be wrong, but at least you need to understand what they're saying.
Well, now, you're a scientist, and according to research, there's no documentation to justify those fears.
The fears of pedophiles?
They're two distinct things. Pedophilia and transgender are two distinctly different things.
Exactly, and that's the point I was trying to say.
Okay.
The liberals were trying to conflate them to say that the Republicans are fearful of transgender people. I'm saying, no, that's not what they're concerned about. They're concerned about sex offenders. They may be right or wrong about that, but it is a legitimate concern, and those on the left weren't willing to listen to that, while those on the right weren't willing to listen to the concerns of the transgender people.
But I
can see both sides.
Did they go too far?
I think the city went too far, and I think the state legislature went too far.
And the legislature has had this habit in recent years of reaching into local affairs. That they've done it in Asheville. They've done it, I think, in Greensboro or Wake County. They've done it here with the airport. They've done it now with the LGBTQ ordinance as well. Is that what Republicans believe? Because it seems that a lot of national Republicans believe in states' rights, and they don't want the federal government to interfere. So why should the state government interfere in local government?
The Constitution of the state of North Carolina provides that cities and counties are creations of the state and therefore are subject to the laws of the General Assembly. So there's no question that they have the constitutional right.
But philosophically fit in with what Republicans believe normally?
I personally have been more aligned with local decisions at the local level. But what I'm trying to say here is just as the liberal Democrats on the city council went too far. If they had not put in the bathroom thing, the rest of it would have been secure. No one would have objected to that in the General Assembly.
Why not just
the Charlotte Observer predicted that that would happen, that they had left that out. Right. And so when the General Assembly gets together, the bill introduced would have just corrected that one issue as far as the conservatives were concerned. But in their zeal and enthusiasm, they began to add other things. For example, they took away the ability of someone, not just LGBT, but all groups, that minorities that are protected by the law. It takes away the right to protect and enforce your rights in state courts. That was in the Charlotte Observer just yesterday. And I expect most members, Democrats and Republicans, when that bill was being voted on, probably didn't understand what that meant, that little provision in there.
Somebody
but
did.
They did. Yeah, somebody did. Somebody put it in there. And that happens a lot when you're rushing to get something done. Why were they rushing? Mm. Because they had to make a deadline before the city's ordinance would take effect. And so what's needed is, over the next legislative session, when they come in and start working, the two sides do need to sit down together and see what's really important to each side and how to deal with it in a way that won't offend the other side.
Governor McCrory is coming.
You think that can happen?
I think anything can happen.
Yeah, okay.
The Governor McCrory has come under criticism for taking, I don't know, 3 nanoseconds to sign that bill after the legislature passed it. As governor, had you been governor and the legislature had passed that law, would you have taken more time to be reflective? Or because you were known for taking a cerebral approach while in office, would you have taken more time before you signed the bill? Or would you have signed
the bill? Well, I don't know how much time Governor McCrory did take.
A couple hours?
You said nanosecond.
A couple hours.
How do you know? I mean, was he not aware of the issue until after it passed?
No, he knew about it. He could have waited a day or two to sign it.
So he had reflected.
All right, okay. Yeah. All right. So you're saying he probably did think
about it. I'm saying let's be fair with each other on each side.
And all right.
It's so easy for the extreme left to blame the extreme right and for the extreme right to blame the extreme left, and they just blame each other and they don't have to listen to each other.
Okay.
Because they don't get votes from the other's constituents.
This sounds very reasonable, John Hood. This philosophy that he's espousing sounds very reasonable to me. Could he make it today as a politician?
Probably not.
I disagree with you on this, Governor. I think you could very well. I think this conversation of the last few minutes demonstrates exactly why. This particular dispute in North Carolina originated in Charlotte with, as you say, an ordinance that was poorly drafted. They had, in fact, a whole year to do it right and didn't do it right for reasons I think are fairly obvious. They wanted the controversy to erupt. The legislature didn't take their time. There are aspects of this bill that probably will be revisited in the short session. And essentially, as Mike was asking you and you were answering the questions, this illustrates the nature of the problem that we were talking about. The original ordinance did not define gender identity. So people assume, well, this allows transgendered people to go into a bathroom that fits their gender. And other people hear it and say, actually, there's no definition, so anybody can say that they're identifying with the other gender for the purposes of going into a man going into a woman's bathroom for deleterious intent. That's the example of you have to listen to each other and reason towards a solution that at least most people can accept rather than jumping to conclusions, because the two arguments are quite different, and that depends on how you read a particular ordinance and then talk about it.
I have an email.
You know, one other aspect of this, right now you're see the news stories about various corporations and sports organizations that are expressing concern. There's nothing in this law, as I understand it, that would prevent them from doing what they want to do if they want to provide unisex bathrooms or opportunities for anybody or for certain groups to be able to exercise their preference on that. They can do that now if they want to. The city of Charlotte could do that with its buildings. The Coliseum could do that if they want to. But the issue is, should they be able to require other businesses to have to do that?
As you look at the presidential
race. Now, very small businesses, they might just have one bathroom and with signs of both figures on the door.
As you look at the presidential campaign this year, what are your thoughts?
I wish that the Republicans had started off with just two or three or four candidates campaigning. By having so many, what happened was this very it's not unprecedented, but it's a curious result that someone with no majorities in any state, but plurality after plurality after plurality, to walk away with them.
But the conversation is not like the one we've been having.
Oh, you're asking a different question.
Well, I think what you just said is accurate, but I mean the conversation has devolved into this eighth grade schoolyard braggadocio thing. What's that all about?
It's almost like the late 18th century and early 19th century debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists.
Is this a fight for the soul of the Republican Party?
Muckraking that went on back then.
Is this the fight for the soul of the Republican Party?
In a sense, it is, yes.
Where do you see it going, John Hood? You watch this as a professional.
I think that this is a Donald Trump story, basically. And I think that if he is denied the nomination, presumably at the convention, then the forces of good will prevail. We put it as simple as that.
He got you on that.
Well, that came out of nowhere.
You wondered where he was going.
John Hood is the author of Catalyst, Jim Martin and the Rise of North Carolina Republicans. I had so much more I wanted to talk with you about Governor Martin, but I didn't get to it. So come back. Thank you
for the invitation.